Phil is a graduate of our well-known honors program at McGill, and I had the privilege of serving as his thesis supervisor at that time. And it was a privilege because Phil, in fact, was already functioning more like a colleague than a student. His thesis was on concepts of potency and resistance in causal prediction, which seemed like a pretty interesting thing at the time, and in fact was published in a very high-profile journal, Child Development. On the walking over here this morning, I ran into a colleague who spontaneously said that he not only knew this paper, but he actually remembered it better than I did, and actually used it in his research. So that was a pretty good start, Phil. Subsequently, Phil went on to earn his PhD from Yale University, and since then has worked at University of Toronto, where he became professor of psychology, associate professor of psychiatry, and Canada Research Chair in developmental neuroscience. Phil currently holds an endowed chair at the Institute of Child Development, University of Minnesota. Using a variety of sophisticated techniques, Phil works on the development of executive function, self-reflection and awareness, and affective decision-making. And for this work, Phil has won a number of significant awards, including the Boyd McCandless Young Scientist Award from APA, the Premier's Excellence Award from the Province of Ontario. He was elected in Canada's top 40 under 40. Of course, that was a few years ago, right? And most recently has been an APS fellow. He has been associate editor of Cognitive Development, the editor of Journal of Cognition and Development, has been on the board of directors of the Cognitive Development Society and the Jean Piaget Society. I think much less well known among psychologists is that Phil was also associate editor of something called the Queen Street Quarterly, which is a forum for the contemporary Canadian arts. Today, Phil is going to tell us about some math modeling work that he's been doing with Stuart Markovich on the early development of executive function. So please join me in welcoming Phil Zelazo.
I'd like to thank the organizers for giving me this opportunity to share some of our work with you. I am going to start with a review of our approach to the development of executive function, and then I'm going to tell you a little bit about a paradigm for studying executive function in children, in children's behavior, search for hidden objects, and then I'll, in this context, describe a recent model of the mechanisms underlying search, mechanisms that we believe are involved in the early development of executive function, and I'll present a bit of data that have been generated by this approach. So, to begin with, what is executive function? Executive function basically refers to the psychological processes that are involved in deliberate cognitive control of thought, action, and emotion. These are processes that are related to but different from intelligence. Executive function has more to do with acting on the basis of what you know than it does with possessing that knowledge in the first place. It's long been known that executive function depends importantly on the integrity of neural systems involving prefrontal cortex. The consequences of prefrontal cortical damage have informed our characterization of executive function since the 19th century. You're probably familiar with the famous case of Phineas Gage, who had a tamping iron blown through the front part of his head. He survived, and despite recovery of general cognitive functions, basic memory, language, and the like, he was, as his attending physician put it, fitful, irreverent, devising many plans of future operations which are no sooner arranged than they're abandoned in turn for others appearing more feasible. And this really captures the essence of executive function, again, translating action into knowledge. patients with prefrontal cortical damage exhibit what's sometimes referred to as a dysexecutive syndrome that's characterized by distraction, cognitive inflexibility or rigidity, lack of self-awareness, impulsivity, and environmental dependency. The French neurologist François Lhermitte noted that patients with prefrontal cortical damage sometimes exhibit rigid, stimulus-driven behavior, failing to take the current context into consideration. He had one patient who had been a nurse prior to her injury, and when she came into his office, he casually arranged some props on his desk, a blood pressure gauge and a stethoscope, tongue depressor, and the like, and she just proceeded to pick these up and use them in the way that she had during her career as a nurse, an example of environmental dependency or stimulus-bound behavior. How best to understand executive function in psychological terms remains a matter of debate. It's sometimes treated as a higher order central executive or supervisory attentional system. In short, a kind of cognitive module that produces effective executive function. So we see in Alan Baddeley's model of working memory, a module here that corresponds to the central executive. Norman and Challis's model includes a supervisory attentional system, which the philosopher Daniel Dennett referred to once as an ominously wise overseer homunculus who handles the hard cases in the workshop of consciousness. And so you see the problem with these kinds of approaches that treat executive function as a module. In our own attempts to understand executive function, we've taken seriously the suggestion from Alexander Luria, a pioneer in the study of this topic, that executive function really is a function. It's not a mechanism or a cognitive structure. And like other functions, it's defined in terms of what it accomplishes. It's something that someone does. And in this case, what's accomplished is deliberate, goal-directed problem solving. And so from this perspective, you can reason that in order to solve a problem in this deliberate, goal-directed fashion, you have to first represent the problem, then you have to formulate a plan, then you have to keep that plan in mind and actually act on it, and finally, you need to evaluate the results of that action, potentially going back and revising your representation of the problem space or what have you. And so let me give you an example from a famous measure of executive function typically in adult patients, the Wisconsin card sorting test. Patients are shown target cards like these, and on each trial they see a test card like this, and they have to guess on which dimension to match the test card to the target cards. And they're given feedback, simple yes-no feedback. After reaching a criterion of cards sorted correctly, the examiner switches the criterion unbeknownst to the participant and then starts giving negative feedback. What patients with prefrontal cortical damage do is they persist in sorting according to that initial rule, that initial criterion. And interestingly, Teuber noted a curious dissociation between knowing and doing. So these patients will sometimes say, well, I know I'm going to get this wrong, but then they just nonetheless continue to sort it by that initial dimension. So on this task, you have to construct a representation of the problem space. You got to be able to identify the presence of these three relevant dimensions. You have to choose a plan. So now we're going to sort by shape. You have to keep that plan in mind. You have to actually carry it out, potentially despite interference from a prepotent tendency to sort by that initial rule. And then you have to evaluate your behavior. You have to attend to the feedback you're getting from the examiner and use it to revise your behavior. So failures of executive function can occur in any of these phases, possibly resulting in rigidity or perseverative behavior. An advantage of this approach, of course, is that it becomes possible to consider these subfunctions of executive function in terms of more fundamental functions or more basic cognitive processes, and this allows us to formulate theories of executive function. Okay, I am going to now say a little bit about our theoretical approach to the topic, executive function and its development, formulated within a levels of consciousness framework. There are a number of complementary theories that are targeting different aspects of the phenomenon. Most recently, with Will Cunningham, we've been working on an iterative reprocessing model of the role of executive function in evaluation of stimuli, including affective assessment and emotion regulation. In general, within this framework, we start with the observation that there are age-related increases in executive function. This is obvious to anybody who's ever looked at children. There are marked increases, for example, between about 3 and 5 years of age in children's ability to control their behavior, think about the future, etc. These are understood in terms of corresponding increases in the complexity of the action-oriented knowledge structures that children are able to formulate and keep in mind and use in a top-down fashion to control their behavior. These increases in complexity are further understood in terms of corresponding increases in the degree to which children can reflect upon and reprocess their own representations. And this, in turn, is to be understood in terms of the iterative reprocessing of information in neural circuits involving prefrontal cortex. I'm going to say a little bit more about this theoretical framework, emphasizing three key notions: the notion of verbal mediation, rule complexity, and reflective reprocessing. So, according to this approach, controlled behavior of the sort in question is quite literally due to private speech, potentially silent, self-directed speech that's maintained in working memory or in activated long-term memory. That's the idea of verbal mediation of this sort of behavior. Reflection on rules allows for the formulation of more complex nested systems, hierarchical systems of rules that allow for more flexibility and control across a wider range of situations. And reflection is made possible by the reprocessing, as I mentioned, of information in prefrontal cortex. I want to illustrate each of these notions in terms of a paradigm that we developed some years ago, and we've since collected a lot of data using this paradigm, and so have people in other laboratories. So this is a measure called the dimensional change card sort, similar in some respects to the Wisconsin card sorting test that I told you about. Children, typically 3 to 5 year old children, but this is a measure that can be used usefully across the entire lifespan, are presented with target cards like these, and then on each trial they're shown a test card like this that would be sorted differently depending on whether you're sorting by shape or by color. And children are told to use a particular pair of rules, for example, shape. They're told to sort by shape. If it's a car, it goes here. If it's a flower, it goes there. After a certain number of trials, they're told to stop. We're not going to play the shape game anymore. We're going to play a new game, the color game. If it's red, I want you to put it over here, but the blue ones have to go over there. And typically what happens is, regardless of whether you start with shape or color, three-year-olds persist in sorting by that initial dimension. And they do this, interestingly, despite demonstrating knowledge of these post-switch rules. So if you ask a child who's perseverating according to shape, where do the red ones go, they can tell you the correct answer. They can point to the correct box. But then you say, okay, but where does this red one go? And that same child will perseverate and sort it according to color. So like with the patients, you have this curious dissociation between knowing and doing. In contrast, by 4 years of age, children switch flexibly. They seem to know immediately when they see these stimuli that they know two different ways of engaging with those stimuli, and so they seem alert to the cues that indicate which pair of rules is in effect. This is a very simple measure of task switching. In research with adults, for example, by Emerson and Miyake, has shown that performance on this type of task is impaired by articulatory suppression. If you have to repeat something like Monday, Monday, Monday over and over again while you're doing this task, you end up perseverating. Similar work has been conducted with children by Uta Cray and Ullman Lindenberger and colleagues. Let me now try to characterize what we think is going on in terms of the representations that children are formulating in this task, to illustrate the idea of rule complexity. We've suggested that children consciously formulate an integrated pair of rules that capture the pre-switch rules. If it's a car, put it here. If it's a flower, put it there. Then, when they're given the post-switch rules, they consciously formulate a pair of rules that corresponds to those rules. They understand, they can get their mind around, as it were. Thank you. The post-switch rules. Thanks. And what they have difficulty doing, however, is stepping back and reflecting upon those two pairs of rules and considering them in contradistinction. They have difficulty integrating them into a hierarchical system of rules that allows them to say, well, if we're playing the shape game, it goes over here. But if we're playing the color game, that same card would be sorted differently over there. And in the absence of that kind of higher order rule for integrating these lower order rules, which particular rule pair comes to control behavior is elicited in a more bottom-up, stimulus-driven fashion of the sort I referred to earlier. So, interestingly, there's evidence for both the persistent activation of rules that are used in the pre-switch phase and also the persistent suppression of the rules that are not used in the pre-switch phase, but I won't say any more about that. The notion of reflective reprocessing. Instead of responding directly to the most low-resolution salient aspects of the stimulus, reflective reprocessing is interposed between the stimulus and the response, moving us away from what John Dewey, the philosopher, referred to as the exigencies of the situation. And this allows for a labeling of that initial experience. The label can then be decoupled from the ongoing perceptual stimulation, maintained in working memory, and used in a top-down fashion to control behavior. And we've tried to map out the implications of different degrees of reflection for the complexity of the knowledge structures that children are able to formulate and use in this way. So, in contrast to the common sense notion that somebody is either conscious or not conscious of something, even in models like Damasio's and Edelman's that distinguish between two different levels of consciousness, primary versus higher order consciousness or whatever, in this approach, there are multiple levels of consciousness. You can be conscious of something at one level, but not further reflect upon it, and that will have implications for your flexibility and the control of behavior across situations. So, each level of consciousness has different consequences for the quality of subjective experience. So reflection allows for a richer characterization, for example, of a stimulus. New details get integrated into the experience before it's replaced by ongoing perceptual stimulation. It has implications for recollection, as in Craik and Lockhart's famous levels of processing theory, which could be thought of as a kind of special case of this more general levels of consciousness approach. And that was, of course, an important inspiration for our thinking along these lines. And it has implications, as I've suggested, for the complexity of knowledge structures. And that's what's most directly relevant to executive function and its development. I can summarize up the implications of reflection by saying that reflection on the contents of consciousness vis-a-vis a situation permits the increasingly sophisticated amplification and selection of attention, or the selection and amplification of attention to particular details in the situation that then come to play a causal role in the elicitation of behavior. There's an age-related increase in the highest level of consciousness that children are believed to be able to muster in response to situational demand. So there's a developmental story here. But in addition to changes in upper limits, there are developmental changes in the probability of reflection that seem to extend into adolescence. And of course, adults operate on different levels of reflection or consciousness in different situations, depending on a variety of things. fatigue, temperament, motivation, etc. So, reflection is effortful, it's cumulative, and it unfolds in time in this way. So there's a kind of elaboration of interpretive processes yielding a richer experience. On this model, reflective reprocessing is taken to be a primary function of lateral prefrontal cortex, one that, in effect, accomplishes other things that are typically attributed to prefrontal cortical function, like working memory. So reprocessing allows the maintenance of information in working memory. Inhibitory control, being able to select and attend relevant aspects of the context, allows for the execution of appropriate behavior and the corresponding inhibition of inappropriate behavior and so forth. There's evidence that different regions of prefrontal cortex are important for rule use at different levels of complexity and hence for different degrees of reflection. And we've suggested that with development, executive function may involve the recruitment of additional hierarchically arranged regions of prefrontal cortex into an integrated network of activations. There's evidence recently from Moriguchi and Hiraki using the dimensional change card sort that I told you about, suggesting that five-year-old children who typically switch flexibly and those three-year-olds who do well on the task show an increase in blood flow after the stimuli are presented on the dimensional change card sort, whereas an increase in blood flow in this case, ventrolateral prefrontal cortex, in contrast to children who perseverate, who show a decrease in blood flow in those same regions that we believe to be important for reflection and rule use. Another recent study with teenagers and young adults shows activation in dorsolateral prefrontal cortex during performance on this task. But of course, regions of prefrontal cortex interact with other regions of the brain. They're part of an integrated system. And other regions like the superior parietal cortex and perhaps especially the anterior cingulate cortex, which seems to signal the need for this kind of reflective reprocessing and the recruitment of lateral prefrontal cortex in this sort of way. For those organisms who are capable of this kind of reflection, you get this error detection or conflict detection signaling that, okay, I need to pay attention. I need to reflect and behave in a top-down fashion. There's been a lot of research in recent years on the marked changes in executive function that take place between about 2 and 5 years of age or so. There's much less work on executive function prior to this period, partly because it's more difficult to study. But one context in which the emergence and early development of executive function can be studied is search for hidden objects. This paradigm has all the features of deliberate goal-directed problem solving. An object is hidden, and so it needs to be kept in mind during a delay, and then this representation needs to be used to constrain your inferences about what to do, and it needs to be used to guide behavior. And often, this has to occur flexibly. So for example, on previous trials, you've successfully searched at one location, and now the object is hidden at a new location, and you have to be able to change your behavior. Research on infant search began with the pioneering work of Walter Hunter at Brown University, who developed the so-called delayed response paradigm. Widely used with non-human animals. In the original versions, there were three unmarked boxes that were arrayed in a semicircle, and there was a cue that indicated that food was hidden in one of those boxes, and then there was a delay imposed, and then the animal was allowed to search for it. And he used that with a variety of animals, including his daughter, Thayer, between the ages of 13 and 16 months. He studied the effect of delay on search, and he found that the longer the delay, the less successful her search. So he noted that Thayer, unlike members of other species, didn't need to maintain a bodily orientation to the correct location during the delay, and he suggested that this might be attributed to the use of some intraorganic factor which is non-observable by the experimenter, what today we would refer to as something like working memory. Search was also famously studied by Jean Piaget as part of his explorations of sensory motor development during infancy and the toddler years. And he, as you probably know, noted that when children were about 8 to 12 months of age, stage 4 of his stages of sensory motor development, they were now able to search for hidden objects, but they exhibited a curious error, a perseverative error called the A not B error. And so the paradigm is typically set up like this. There are a few hiding locations arrayed in a semicircle. An object is conspicuously hidden in one location. There's a delay. The infant is allowed to search for it. 9-month-old infants, say, typically will search correctly for the object, but then the object is retrieved, and it's now conspicuously hidden in a new location, the B location, and a delay is imposed, and infants are allowed to search for it. And these stage 4 9-month-old infants will often return to that initial A location. They'll exhibit a perseverative error, the so-called A not B error. Theoretical counts of the A not B error and its eventual disappearance started with Piaget's characterization of this as important for understanding the child's developing concept of objects, and specifically the idea that objects exist independently of the child's action on those objects. But more recently, people have considered cognitive processes related to executive function, including, for example, memory. An early study by Adele Diamond was looking longitudinally at the length of the delay that was required in order to elicit that perseverative error in infants, and what she found is a fairly linear increase across the age range of 7.5 to 12 months, longer and longer delays being required in order to elicit perseverative behavior. But there's also evidence that memory by itself may be inadequate to account for specifically the phenomenon of perseveration. So, for example, Paul Harris, in an early study, used visible plexiglass hiding containers. So the object wasn't really hidden. It was perfectly visible to the infant. Followed the same paradigm, hid it initially at location A, and the infant retrieved it, and then hid it at location B. And so the infant can actually see that location A is empty and location B is filled, and infants still exhibited perseverative errors searching at location A in that task. Indeed, Piaget had noted that infants sometimes look correctly at the B location even while their hand is reaching out to the A location. So again, there's a kind of curious dissociation between behavior in these two different modalities, at least. So in any case, this kind of work raises the intriguing possibility that there's a dissociation going on between two competing influences on behavior that ultimately need to be integrated. Adele Diamond formulated a memory plus inhibition hypothesis that captures this insight. She suggested that successful search requires both keeping the object's current location in mind and inhibiting a tendency to search at the initial location. She used a 7-location search task like this. And so here's the A location. And then finally, on the switch trials, the object was hidden over at location B. And she observed that infants tended to search between the A and B location, not randomly around the B location, suggesting that it wasn't just forgetting that could account for this pattern of results, but also something drawing the infants back to that initial location. In recent years, a number of models have attempted to make such ideas more theoretically precise, often via formal modeling. Some work by Dehen and Changeur and Yuko Munakata, also Esther Thalen, Linda Smith, and their colleagues, John Spencer. The notion of dynamic field theory and interaction among influences on behavior, Munakata's model deals with the competition between active memory of the object's current location and latent memory of having reached to that initial location, and so forth. And so there are differences among these models, but they're all similar in their effort to account for the effect of task-specific experience on performance as a competition between or among different types of influence. And this finally leads us to the hierarchical competing systems model, which is our effort to develop a competing systems model that accounts for infants' behavior in this type of situation. So, as Tom mentioned, this is work that I've conducted with Stuart Markovich, who is an associate professor at UNC Greensboro. And we developed this model as an effort to address the early development of executive function in a way that connects it up with the later development of executive function and the theoretical models that I told you about earlier. According to this model, there are two basic types of system. There's a response-based system, which is an SR, stimulus-response learning system, the influence of which corresponds to habit strength, the old Hullian construct, and is assumed to be relatively developmentally invariant, not to change with age. In contrast, there's also a conscious representational system that develops through levels of consciousness in the way that I told you about before, including important changes that seem to take place at about the end of the first year of life. So you have something in a very simple schematic that looks like this. There's this conscious representational system that exerts top-down control on behavior. But I'm going to tell you first about the response-based system and our attempts to address the influence of task-specific experience on this response-based system in the context of this A not B type paradigm. The influence of the response-based system alone, habit strength, corresponds to the probability that the response-based system will lead the child to search at location A. So across A trials, as experience builds up, as experience reaching to that A location accumulates, habit strength increases as a kind of asymptotic function. Somewhat more specifically, the probability of searching at location A based just on habit strength is a function of the baseline probability of searching at location A after a single trial, and it's also a function of beta here, which is the rate of increase in habit strength, so the learning rate in effect, and it's also a function of the number of A trials. And so if we use values for those parameters that yield plausible estimates of the influence of habit strength, you get something that looks like this. You have beta, the rate of increase, alpha, the baseline probability of searching at location A, and number of trials. But we also have to take into consideration the potential influence of the conscious representational system. And here, what we're talking about is the influence of the representation of the object at its current location at location B. And this is suggested to be a function of the probability of reflecting on that representation in that kind of iterative reprocessing way that I described earlier. Most likely, in the case of an infant, we're talking about very simple reflection, what would be experienced as simply noticing the object at that new location, which allows for that representation then to be decoupled from the perceptual stimulation, maintained in working memory, used in a top-down fashion, as I suggested earlier. The baseline probability of reflection on any particular trial is captured by this parameter gamma, which is a function of children's developmental level and also task difficulty. I'll say a little bit more about that later. But the probability of reflection across trials is cumulative, and it increases with each trial. So we have somewhat more specifically, the cumulative probability of reflection is a function of this parameter gamma, which represents the probability of reflection on any particular trial and the number of A trials. Using those, using these parameters here, a 4.6% chance of reflection on any given trial, so a low generally probability of reflection in a young infant, you get a function that looks like this across this range of number of A trials. So the cumulative probability of reflecting on a representation, it's suggested in these young infants around 9 months of age or so, starts low but increases steadily with each trial. Of course, the essence of this competing systems model is that search reflects the joint influence of both of these systems. They have to be combined, yielding a function like this. The combined probability of reflection, and hence, in this case, of searching perseveratively at location A, is going to be an inverted U-shaped function of the number of A trials. So this is the first prediction that this model yields, which is that children will be more likely to search perseveratively after a moderate number of A trials than after fewer or more A trials. We might ask, why in psychological terms could this happen? The idea is that A trial experience increases habit strength, the tendency to go to location A, but it does so to an asymptote. It also provides, each A trial provides cumulative opportunities for reflection, for noticing the task structure, noticing that there are these multiple hiding locations, noticing that the object has been moved. And this cumulative probability of reflection accumulates more gradually than habit strength increases. So with additional trials, the tendency to perseverate first increases, but then decreases. So what actually happens if you vary the number of A trials in this paradigm? A number of years ago, on the basis of an early meta-analysis in the mid-80s by Henry Wellman and his colleagues, it seemed that number of A trials didn't have any effect at all, and this notion was taken up in the literature. These other theories that I mentioned, but didn't go into detail, like dynamic field theory and Munakata's active latent memory model, predict that with increases in A trials, you're going to get an increase in perseveration up to an asymptote, right? So they do not predict an inverted U-shaped function. So as prepotent tendencies are established and potentiated, the tendency to perseverate ought to increase. To examine the number of A trials across a relatively wide age range, Stuart Markovich and Mark Schmuckler and I used a three-location A-not-B task like this one, like I showed you before, with 9-month-old infants who received either 1, 6, or 11 A trials before the object was switched and hidden at location B. And we looked at the proportion of infants who erred, who searched perseveratively in particular, at that on that initial B trial. And what we found was essentially what we predicted, that the proportion of infants who were incorrect and perseverative on that initial B trial first increased and then started to decrease with additional A trials. Data provide a close fit to the model using the parameters that I used earlier to illustrate those separate functions. We subsequently examined 2-year-olds using more challenging search tasks that elicit perseveration at that age. So 2-year-olds will rarely perseverate in the standard A not B task. But if you make the task a little bit more difficult, for example, by requiring them to do a few things in order to retrieve the object, you can get perseveration even in 2-year-olds. And we used, for example, in one study, a multi-step, multi-location search task. They watch as the object is hidden in a plastic bag, and this tray gets pushed in, and they have to pull out the tray, select a symbol, pull the string in order to retrieve a candy. So the critical decision is embedded in this multi-step procedure. We did this study with 2-year-old children, 5 locations. Children received either 1, 6, or 11 trials, finding the object at that initial location before it was hidden conspicuously at the new location, and again, we found evidence of an inverted U-shaped function. Another study used a continuous search space, a sandbox task that was based on earlier work by John Spencer and his colleagues. This yielded a continuous dependent variable reaction time, and we used four conditions which allowed us to assess the existence of a quadratic trend. We had 3, 7, 11, or 15A trials, again with two-year-olds, and we found that the amount of time required to find the object increased up to a peak and then started to decrease again. There was evidence for a quadratic trend. So our efforts to explore this first point have yielded converging evidence of a U-shaped effect of A trials across three tasks and two ages. And this is an interesting prediction because only this model to date suggests that you would see such a non-obvious pattern. The model, the hierarchical competing systems model, generates a number of additional predictions, many of which have not yet been tested, some of which, however, can be considered in light of existing data, and I'll just tell you briefly about a few of these predictions. So based on simulations where alpha and beta were kept constant and gamma, this probability of reflection on any particular trial, assumed to correspond to increasing developmental level or age, was manipulated, we found that as participants get older, the model predicts that the relation between perseverative behavior and the number of A trials should shift from being U-shaped in infancy, as I showed you, to being monotonically decreasing, eventually to disappearing altogether. So with these different values for gamma, but everything else held constant, you get functions that look like this. This is an intermediate level of gamma, probability of reflection 30%, probability of reflection 90%. It basically disappears altogether. And here the idea would be that this corresponds to an adult. If an adult watched on 100 trials, say, an object being hidden at location A, and then the adult was attentive and watched as the object was now switched to location B, the adult is unlikely to perseverate at all, right? So reflection is going to trump any potential influence of habit strength in that situation. But consider a more challenging measure of executive function, the Wisconsin card sorting test that I told you about earlier. In the initial work with this paradigm by David Grant and Esther Berg and colleagues, they in fact varied the number of trials to criterion, the number of pre-switch trials before the rule was changed, and they looked at the probability of making an error, a perseverative error, as a function of number of reinforcing trials, and they found in two different studies that errors decreased as number of trials to criterion increased. There was some suggestion of an initial increase across these studies. So, you know, somewhere in between a moderate or a high level of gamma in terms of this hierarchical competing systems model. Another prediction is that the probability of success can be increased by cues such as labeling the locations that might be expected to prompt reflection on one's representations. And the model suggests that cues would not only lead to improvements in performance to greater success, but also would change the effect of number of A trials on the probability of perseveration in the same way as age. This is something that remains to be tested, but could be tested in a very straightforward fashion. Conversely, search will be affected by manipulations that decrease the likelihood of reflection using a divided attention paradigm, a dual task paradigm, articulatory suppression, something like that, would again produce changes in the nature of that function that are similar to those produced by age, except in this case in reverse. Another prediction, and then I'll tell you about a final one right after this. Children with better motor coordination and hence better motor memory resulting in the establishment of stronger habit strength should display increasing levels of perseveration, paradoxically, right? So children who are developmentally better in terms of motor development would be expected to show more perseveration and require fewer trials at location A in order to achieve these levels. This is based on simulations where the parameters gamma and beta were kept constant, and alpha, the probability of perseveration after any single trial, is postulated to increase with motor coordination, is manipulated. And so you have something like this. You get a shift of this whole function. The character of the function changes a bit, but the main thing is that the probability of perseveration will increase in children who are responding smoothly and consistently, all else being equal. That's a little bit more difficult to test, but the converse prediction is that children with motor delays who exhibit irregular, say, reaching on those A trials will make fewer errors. Again, it's a paradoxical prediction, right? These children who are developmentally delayed in a particular respect will appear to be developmentally advanced in the context of this paradigm because these children will fail to establish a strong habit strength during those initial A trials. So they'll make fewer errors, and the relation between number of A trials and perseveration will be asymptotic instead of this inverted U-shaped function. This is based on simulations where the value of alpha is decreased, resulting in decreased perseveration in the absence of a U-shaped relation. So here is alpha at 0.3, and you get a function that looks like this. Interestingly, Riviere and Lecuyer in 2003 provided some evidence that there is less perseveration seen in search tasks for toddlers, 29-month-olds, who have spinal muscular atrophy and so might be expected to have irregular reaching movements on those A trials. So, establishing perseverative tendencies during the A trials to reach to location A may depend on consistent, stable reaches on those trials. Okay, so let me try to sum up, and then hopefully we'll have a few minutes for questions. The formalization of the hierarchical competing systems model is an important first step, we believe, in connecting research on infancy and toddlerhood with research on executive function in later childhood and indeed across the lifespan. It's intended to provide a foundation for the developmental models of executive function that we've been working on in terms of this levels of consciousness framework. The formalization and quantification helps us to clarify what's assumed by the model as well as what's postulated to develop. Perhaps most importantly, among extant theories of search and indeed developmental theories of executive function, this model is unique in addressing the role of conscious control, of consciousness and conscious reflection in executive function and self-control more generally. But of course, further research is needed to test the unique hypotheses set forth by the model and also to examine whether the model can account for a wider range of phenomena, and we've applied it specifically to this one paradigm, which happens to be among the limited number of paradigms that can be used to assess executive function in young children. I should say in children this young, but it would be obviously useful to develop something that has wider applicability. And that's it. Thank you.
Can you hear me?
Yes.
I very much appreciated what I have heard, because I think that we really need a decomposing of these complicated functions into smaller pieces and then look into the details. I'm not absolutely sure that the specific decomposition that, that you have made is the right one, but I think that's the direction. I would like to go a little bit further because representation building sounds fine to me, but conscious reflection is too complex for me, so we need to go down into building blocks of this and then look into the details of what exactly is actually happening. In that respect, I have a question regarding the U-shape that you observed. So your interpretation is that this is due to more and more self-reflection, but it could also be the case that simply this is a habituation effect. So the more they practice the A task, they get bored and they want to diverge from it, and that's why you get correct results without any self-reflection at all. So
That's a very good point. It's one that we have indeed considered, and I don't think it's incompatible with the approach that we're presenting, which is to say that with habituation across a number of A trials, resources are freed up to, for example, notice the object has now been switched and pay attention to that fact and act on the basis of it. One thing that speaks against a relatively simple notion of habituation, for example, the idea that children are just, you know, getting bored or something like that, they do not make errors on the A trials. And when they make errors on the B trial, regardless of how many A trials preceded the B trial, those errors are systematically perseverative as opposed to random, suggesting again that we're talking about an influence of some processes that are directing the infant to the initial location and some processes that potentially are directing the infant to the correct location. The broader issue of consciousness is, of course, a difficult one to address. And what we have tried to do is say we don't want to ignore the notion of consciousness altogether because we do believe that it plays an important instrumental functional role in executive function and its development. But how do you go about trying to make the problem of consciousness tractable? What we've tried to do is suggest that we're not going to be able to answer what conscious reflection in a minimal characterization might possibly mean. That's taken as a primitive in the context of this model. But we have been able to suggest that if you have that primitive process or function of reflection, you can understand more complex experiences of conscious processing in terms of the iteration, degrees of iteration of that simpler, unanalyzed, postulated function.
So many cognitive scientists think of cognition in terms of what we call the cognitive architecture. Now, in the beginning of your talk, you sort of took some pains to distinguish a functional approach from a mechanistic approach and saying that you advocate the functional approach. But then when you went on to analyze the executive function, you broke it down into things like process, representation and process, which is precisely the mechanistic, if you wish, kind of concepts that fit very well in a cognitive architecture type of framework. So could you elaborate on exactly
sure.
the distinction there?
Yes. I didn't mean to suggest that I'm committed to a functionalist approach all the way down. What I meant to suggest is that the notion of executive function is precisely the function that we want to understand in terms of underlying mechanisms. And so we don't want to treat that as a mechanism. We want to treat that as a function that needs to be understood in terms of more basic functions, some of which might be thought of as mechanisms. Neural mechanisms, for example. I mean, we can think of those as functions too, but they're making reference to, you know, biological hardware.
You certainly are familiar with the recent work by Gergely and collaborators about the role of communicative intentions in the A non B task.
Mm-hmm.
And I am not sure how you would account for that in your model, because prima facie seems to suggest that there are levels of complexity that I don't see how you can show here. Briefly stated, the result is that if the infant has a communicative relation with the experimenter, then he or she will make A-NOMB errors. But if this relation is taken away, the A-NOMB error reduces. I'm interested in your comments.
Yes. Well, I'm not entirely sure how we would account for that. But one possibility is to think in terms of the resources that are available for reflection. I suggested that doing things that increase the likelihood of reflection will improve success, right? And doing things that decrease the likelihood of reflection, for example, demanding resources, right, through divided attention or a dual task paradigm, will decrease the probability of reflection and result in more perseveration. And it seems to me that, you know, one possibility is that when you lay some social communicative exchange on top of an A not B paradigm, that you are using up limited resources and then you know, decreasing the probability of reflection, lowering the value in terms of the model of that parameter gamma, resulting in more perseveration.
In one of the models that you presented, one of your parameter was age. Is that correct?
No. The parameter was this parameter gamma that corresponds to the probability of reflection on any particular trial. And I suggested that that is presumed to increase with age, but also to vary as a function of other things besides age. In fact, I suggested developmental level, but age is often treated as a proxy for developmental level, but of course they're not perfectly correlated.
What do you think is accounting for that gamma? So if it's reflection, what's the, is that the mechanism, the underlying mechanism that you're using in the model? Or is that a result of some mechanism? Do you see what I'm getting at?
Yes, I do. So in terms of the model, that notion of simple reflection is being treated as a primitive, right? And yet we can see, well, what variables affect the value of that parameter? So what contributes to the likelihood of reflection? And age is something that would be expected to be correlated with the probability of reflection. Being unimpeded by other demands, right, would also increase the likelihood of reflection compared to being in a dual task paradigm or something, having those resources used up in some other way. But you could imagine other things. So IQ. You know, age is held constant, but you have some children who have a low IQ and some children who have a high IQ. Well, the higher IQ children might be expected to have a higher probability of reflection.
Thanks. I think I didn't understand how the model deals with delay. I have the impression the model is not really using time.
It's You're not really absolutely
process
right.
Model. Can you explain that?
Yes, it's not at all addressed at this point in terms of this model. And yet we do know, as I suggested, that delay has an effect. This is one of the most well-established findings in research on search in infancy. It could be added relatively easily. One would expect that there would be a relation between certainly the probability of reflection and delay, I think I'd have to think about it a little further to say precisely what that relation would be. But on first analysis, I think I'd say that if you hid the object and you imposed a delay, that the likelihood of reflection occurring and being used to control behavior would probably decrease, right? In other words, there'd be more opportunities for distraction and forgetting during that longer delay. But it's not entirely straightforward. It's a nice point. Because you might expect that, well, time too, as with number of A trials, might increase the likelihood of reflection.
Thank you. Does your model have implications for individuals with developmental disorders, e.g. autism?
Does the model have implications for individual differences, including, for example, individuals with autism? I think it might. It's intended to be, and you can see these questions are usefully revealing how abstract and fundamental our efforts have been to date. But the effort has been to create a kind of framework within which other variables might be considered. So autism, you might imagine, might be associated with a decreased probability of reflection, right? All else being equal. I'm not sure. In other contexts, it might be associated with an increase in the probability of reflection. In the absence of interference or distraction from other kinds of considerations, if an individual were focused specifically on the task at hand. So the hope is that this provides a, as I say, a very foundational framework that would allow us to begin to explore the implications of a variety of variables like delay, like autism and its influence on children's development.
Yes. Would you comment on the extent to which you think that higher level consciousness is necessarily verbally mediated?
Yes. It's another large question and not an easy one by any means to answer. But our position has been that in the context of goal-directed problem solving, that verbal mediation plays an important role, and that assumption has been supported by research of the sort that I mentioned earlier, for example, articulatory suppression impairing performance on measures like task switching, and importantly, not just resulting in random behavior, but resulting in developmentally relatively immature behavior, right? So you see a reversion to perseverative patterns as opposed to just, you know, a disruption of behavior altogether. So that kind of evidence suggests to me that that these sorts of tasks are indeed verbally mediated. Whether or not all conscious reflection needs to be verbally mediated as opposed to, for example, mediated by some other kind of symbol system, or perhaps even, you know, if it's possible to imagine in the absence of a symbol system altogether, I'm not entirely sure. The transition from young infancy to late infancy that we were focusing on in this research, I do think is verbally mediated in a very primitive way, that there has to be some kind of labeling in some fashion. It could be gesture, for example. It could be as simple as, oh, voila, there, là, lo, behold, something like that, that signals, right, and serves as a proxy for the perceptual experience of the object at the particular location. I think, however, that being able to reflect upon and describe one's own representations and consider them in relation to a broader set of contextual considerations, that is something that is, at the very least, greatly facilitated by articulate description.
We are obviously in the process of habituating the speaker to difficult questions.
Yes.
So I thought I'd ask one more.
Why not?
The central to your system is this distinction between reflection and habit-based control of behavior. And there's a long tradition of slicing cognition into two parts, way back to Luria's first and second signal systems, David Marr's various levels of cognition. But the formulation that has been kicked around most recently is between symbolic and subsymbolic cognition. And indeed, we used that terminology to do some, characterize some of the sessions in this conference. So is your reflection, could that be interpreted as symbolic cognition and the habitus system as subsymbolic cognition? Are we ready to start unifying different portions of cognitive science around that distinction?
I think so. I think that's a useful way to put it. And indeed, I'd be quite comfortable with that characterization. One of the other kinds of dichotomies that this bears an obvious resemblance to is the notion of dual processes, you know, automatic and controlled processes or something like that. And what we've tried to do is build upon that kind of dichotomy by creating a more nuanced characterization of controlled processes as not just completely controlled versus completely automatic or unconscious versus conscious, but to break down what is meant by conscious control and suggest that there are degrees of automaticity, degrees of conscious control, degrees of reflection that have meaningful consequences for behavior and yield these kinds of dissociations that are so prevalent in research on executive function. Dissociations between looking and reaching or being able to say the rules but then not use them 2 seconds later and so forth.
Okay, well, thank you, Phil, for a great talk.
Thank you. Okay.